Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Many thanks for joining us here on Spotlight on Europe. It's always a pleasure to have you on board as we take a look at major events here in Europe, but from an African perspective. My name is Jane Nyinge, and of course, we've got a lot lined up for you, including breaking down the culture of silence surrounding sexual harassment in France.
Now it's becoming easier because we're together. It's always more difficult when you're alone to say, this happened to me. Sometimes the police will not believe you. Sometimes your family won't believe you. But if we're all together saying the same thing, maybe it changed.
And here in Germany, we hear how the government is grappling with the challenge of finding new police recruits. Well, for these stories and much more, please stick around for the next 30 minutes. We start off in Spain, and the question which occupied many Spanish people this week is, where in the world is Carles Puigdemont? The separatist leader of Catalonia disappeared and then popped up in France and Belgium. The Spanish government fired him after he presided over an independence referendum and later a declaration of independence. Madrid has now issued a European arrest warrant for the former leader. Lauren Freyer reports from Barcelona.
As part of its takeover of Catalonia, Spain fired all of the regional government's ministers and warned they could be arrested if they tried to show up for work this week. Only one ex-minister did, Josep Rull. He went into his office Monday morning, tweeted a photo of himself at his desk, and then abruptly left amid word police were coming for him. Supporters clapped as he fled the building surrounded by TV cameras. The deposed Catalan president, Carles Puigdemont, posted a photo the same day on Instagram, showing the view from the window of his office with a smiley face emoji. He seemed to be suggesting he was inside, but how? The building was surrounded by police and journalists. No one spotted him going in. The sky in his photo was cloudy, suggesting it was taken on a different day. Was he playing games? As mystery and speculation swirled, Spain's top prosecutor, José Manuel Maza, spoke in Madrid.
Por delitos de rebelión, sedición, malversación y otros conexos.
Announcing he's pressing charges of rebellion, sedition and embezzlement against Puigdemont and his former government. They carry penalties of up to 30 years in prison. Then news broke of another surreal twist. Puigdemont was not even in this country.
Ha contratado como consejero a un abogado belga que defendió a presos etarras.
He'd secretly fled Spain, traveling to France, then Belgium. In Brussels, he's hired a lawyer, Paul Bécart, a man who had defended Basque terrorists in the past. A detail that did not go down well with Spanish officials. A spokesman for Spain's ruling conservatives, Fernando Martínez Maillo.
Sinceramente, es un desatino y es una muestra de desesperación.
Honestly, this is nonsense, an act of desperation. The only people who talk to him are fringe nationalists like himself.
Puigdemont has been meeting with Flemish nationalists in Belgium. He says he'll stay there indefinitely and won't return to Spain without legal guarantees. He held a lengthy, rambling news conference in Brussels, speaking in four languages.
I am not here in order to demand asylum, political asylum. This is not a Belgian question. I'm here in Brussels as a capital of Europe.
Europe must react, he said, to the separatist conflict in Catalonia. He said his number one priority is to avoid violence and that he'll respect the results of fresh Catalan elections set for December 21st. Puigdemont took five of his government ministers with him to Belgium. But two of them unexpectedly returned to Spain after just a day and were deluged by protesters at Barcelona's airport. Yelling that the ex-minister should go to prison. Even some of Puigdemont's own supporters are angry. He led this separatist movement, declared independence, and now has he abandoned them? Laia Lobet is a Catalan school teacher.
Claro, es como que se va en un momento muy importante, ¿no?
He's just up and left at the most important moment. I think he should be here, standing with the Catalan people.
She wants Puigdemont to come back and run an election set for December 21st. Two civic leaders of the Catalan independence movement have already been arrested and charged with sedition. Llobet says it's unfair for Puigdemont to leave them behind, languishing in jail.
Ellos están en la cárcel y él no está aquí. Es muy, muy injusto.
They're in jail, and he isn't even here. It's really, really unfair. It's unfair that they ended up in jail, but even worse with what's happened since then.
Others are more sympathetic. Alberto de Ros, a Catalan engineer, says Puigdemont had no choice but to flee.
What do you want? Puigdemont to stay here and go to prison 30 years for what? For say, Catalonia is independent? It's stupid. You know, it's stupid for everyone that believes that. It's stupid.
Puigdemont is in Brussels, but it's unclear whether or for how long the Belgian government will allow him to stay. Meanwhile, the Catalan regional police force Puigdemont used to command has now been placed under Madrid's control, and his photo is being taken down from the walls of police stations across Catalonia. Lauren Freyer, DW, Barcelona.
Moving on, the Harvey Weinstein scandal is still sending shockwaves across the Atlantic. In France, a recent poll found more than half of women have faced some sort of sexual abuse or harassment. Today, the culture of shutting up about it appears to be ending. There have been nationwide rallies against sexual violence across France. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The sounds of an age-old tradition. Over the months and years, the French have taken to the streets against terrorism, economic reforms, education cuts, and pensions. Now, anger over sexual harassment is the rallying cry du jour.
So, solidarité avec les femmes du monde entier.
On Sunday, the Place de la République in Paris was packed with protesters.
Almost every woman has a sad history, something not very agreeable, trauma and very hard situations.
Freelance journalist Carole Galland was behind the protests that were also held in other French cities, and she too has been sexually harassed.
Now it's becoming easier because we're together. It's always really more difficult when you're alone to say, this happened to me. Sometimes the police will not believe you. Sometimes your family won't believe you. But if we're all together saying the same thing, maybe it changed.
Solidarité avec les femmes du monde entier. Solidarité.
This is not the first time sexual harassment is making headlines here. There was former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn. The allegations ended Strauss-Kahn's political career, but criminal charges against him were dropped in the New York case, and he was cleared of the pimping charges in France. Last year, Green Party politician Denis Baupin quit his post as vice president of France's National Assembly after four women accused him of unwanted come-ons. The case against him was also dropped, this time on grounds that the alleged events took place too long ago to prosecute. A former Green Party leader, Sandrine Rousseau, is one of the accusers. She claims Baupin pushed her against a wall and kissed her. She's recently published a book about the experience and launched an association for victims of sexual abuse.
La France est un pays où il y avait une tolérance très forte vis-à-vis des violences sexuelles. Oui.
France is a country with a very strong tolerance towards sexual violence. There's this kind of pickup à la française and a determination not to look at things straight on, which can lead to sexual violence.
Things are changing, Rousseau says. It's like a locked door that's slowly being knocked down.
Les policiers, la justice, les juges ne peuvent plus faire comme si de rien ne s'était passé.
The police, the justice system, the judges can't pretend as if nothing has happened. They can't simply dismiss cases. They will be obliged to investigate and pronounce judgment.
It does seem like France has reached a tipping point. Other politicians are speaking out about their harassment experiences, from former French Environment Minister Ségolène Royal to current Health Minister Agnès Buzyn. A recent survey published by Le Figaro newspaper found more than half of French women have been victims of sexual harassment. A separate poll last year in the city of Bordeaux was even more striking. It found 4 out of 5 women had experienced some form of street harassment, from whistling and stares to touching, masturbation, and threats.
Les femmes, elles réagissent quand même. C'est-à-dire qu'elles vont mettre en place des stratégies d'évitement.
Women do react. They put in place strategies of evading, of fleeing, or disgust. But they don't denounce it, because it's very difficult to accumulate proof. When you're harassed, you don't think about taking out your phone to film what's happening, and nor do witnesses.
Sociologist Laetitia Franquet co-authored the Bordeaux survey. In neighboring Spain, she says, feminist movements are strong and speak out against sexual harassment. Not so in France.
Aujourd'hui, quand vous demandez à une femme si elle est féministe, elle va te dire non, absolutely pas. Moi, je ne suis pas.
If you ask a woman today if they are feminist, they will say, absolutely not. I'm not an hysterical extremist who detests men. That's the image of feminists held today by many young women. And unfortunately, it prevents a huge women's action movement emerging.
The government plans to channel today's anger into legislation. Under discussion are fines for catcalling, increasing the age of consent for minors, and a broader definition of rape that is not limited to penetration. At the Paris rally, protester Anouk Delport thinks still more is needed. She considers herself lucky. She's only had one bad experience.
It was harassed. I was 16 in the street. I was coming back home, and a guy just started to touch me, and luckily my brother was at home, and when I just asked for the door to open, my brother was there, and it was the end.
She believes stopping sexual harassment needs to start even in ordinary conversations. Changing the entrenched attitudes of an entire nation is going to take a long time. But if they start in schools, Delport thinks, they may have a chance.
I hope that the men will realize what all the women and girls in this country must live with. And that we'll start to think, oh, when there is a stupid joke, I should say, hey, stupid. I should react as man. Because it's so easy for the man not to say anything, and for the woman to say something, you're always, oh, you're the feminist, you're just not, you don't have humor, we just have fun. But it's not fun.
Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
Now, some of the first women to speak publicly about Harvey Weinstein's allegedly predatory behavior were Italian. Filipina-Italian model Amra Batilana was the first to report Weinstein to the police after she says he assaulted her in a hotel. And Italian actor-director Asia Argento was one of the first women to go on record for the New Yorker magazine about her alleged rape by the Hollywood producer. But while women are rallying around the alleged victims in North America and elsewhere, the reception online and in the media in Italy has been marked by what could be called classic victim blaming. Megan Williams has more from Rome.
I'm really tired. It'll be great. It's if you give me a massage.
This is a scene from the movie Scarlet Diva that Italian Asia Argento directed a few years after she says Harvey Weinstein raped her. She says when she showed it to the Hollywood producer, he laughed, recognizing it was him.
I'm not the big bad wolf. Just think of me as a teddy bear.
Argento found a way through her film to record what she says Weinstein did to her in a hotel room when she was a 21-year-old actor. But it took more than 2 decades for her to gather the courage to tell her story publicly, as part of last month's The New Yorker article that chronicled multiple allegations of sexual assault by Weinstein. Weinstein has denied allegations of non-consensual sex. An Italian version of the hashtag MeToo campaign was launched on Twitter. But despite the support, Argento has been the target of widespread hostility here in Italy after going public with the alleged assault. A number of older male opinion makers went on radio talk shows and wrote columns accusing Argento of everything from prostitution, because she continued to see Weinstein, to Argento, not Weinstein, being the real aggressor. Right-wing columnist Vittoria Feltri asked whether or not she enjoyed what he called, quote, a little lick, and said if she wasn't tied up, it wasn't rape.
Ha detto che alle donne piace una leccatina, capisci?
Fed up with the accusations against her, Argento went on the Italian public broadcaster Rai TV to denounce the assault by what she called the misogynists in Italy attacking her.
Una violenza inaudita.
Feminist educator and filmmaker Lorella Zanardo says she first heard about the allegations against Weinstein when she was giving a talk in Chicago.
I was following the news in US and seeing the reaction from the American actresses.
Then she returned back home to Italy.
In my country, the case was not Mr. Weinstein raping the actresses. But in Italy, the case was more about what women thought of Asia Argento. Are you with or against Asia Argento?
Ma chi ti vuole vedere? Perdo il lavoro, non faccio il provino. Pace!
Women, including those who work in show business here, as much as men, have questioned Argento's story and motives, accusing her of using sex in exchange for career advances.
Men, and above all women, have written hate messages against Asia.
Luisa Rizzitelli is spokeswoman for a hotline for abused women. She says victim blaming is widespread in a country where she says the Catholic Church and patriarchy dominate, not to mention the hostile climate to women after years of former leader Silvio Berlusconi, renowned for his sexism. It's a climate that has affected both men and women, she says.
Women in Italy got a big problem with interiorized violence. They just reduce the problem to one person. The focus is in Italy not the molester, not the man that abuser, but the victim.
Tornerò quando le cose miglioreranno per combattere le battaglie con tutte le altre donne.
For her part, Asia Argento has decided to leave Italy for now, saying she'll come back when things change to fight alongside women on the issue of sexual assault and harassment. In the meantime, she's active on Twitter, supporting other women who denounce Weinstein and other alleged sexual abusers. She's also threatened to sue anyone who defames her. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome. For this dance, you don't do shagara. Oh, yeah, I need a
Well, if you've just joined us, this is Spotlight on Europe coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And yes, you can keep talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or leave us a voice note on our WhatsApp. A decent salary, a secure position and respect from society. For many years, plenty of young Germans dreamed of becoming a police officer. Well, now there are more opportunities than ever to become one. After years of slashing jobs, Germany's police force wanted to hire around 15,000 new recruits this year alone. But strangely enough, they've been struggling to find enough qualified applicants. So what has gone wrong? Our correspondent Daniel Pels has more from Berlin.
Happy Vorzeit! Mündung geht nach unten. Mündung geht nach unten.
It's training time at Berlin's police academy. Almost 30 recruits in dark blue training overalls and black caps are standing on the academy's basketball court. On the shouted orders from their instructors, they practice cocking and locking their machine guns. Minutes later, they are lying flat on the ground, pointing their guns at an invisible enemy.
MP.
The fresh-faced recruits, all in their early 20s, have just started their second year of training. One of them is 22-year-old Ugur.
Im Vorfeld hat man ja eher die Gedanken im Kopf, dass das als Polizist wirklich aufzutreten, ein Polizist zu sein, was...
I always thought that it's great to be a police officer. My family holds this job in high esteem. My parents were very proud of me when I was accepted at the academy. As a police officer, you have a certain presence in the community, and you have to be very conscientious every day.
Germany's police are desperately looking for more young recruits who are as excited about the job as Ugur. This year, they want to hire an estimated 15,000 new officers for the different police forces in the country. But why does Germany need so many new officers all of a sudden? Andrea Sievert is the chief recruitment manager of Berlin's local police force.
Wir haben jahrelang eine relativ stringente Sparpolitik in Berlin fahren müssen.
Berlin had to implement austerity measures for years in order to reduce the deficit in our budget. The police was also affected by that. We did not shed jobs, but we could not hire additional officers. Now, more and more people are coming to Berlin and live here, so we need more officers who can attend to the residents.
And the problem is getting worse. Germany's police are growing older and older. Jörg Radek is the deputy chairman of the German Police Union, GDP.
Wir sind da jetzt gerade auf einer Aufholjagd. Wir haben ja jahrelang erlebt, dass Personal reduziert wurde bei der Polizei.
For years, many jobs in the German police were cut. Now we are looking for new staff, but it's harder to find them because Germany's population is shrinking. We are competing with industry, the business sector and other areas of public service. The police has to do more if it wants to remain an attractive employer.
One issue, Radek says, is pay. Each German police service pays its officers differently. That can lead to absurd situations in a city like Berlin. A federal police officer patrolling Berlin's main train station earns a different salary than the provincial police officer who is patrolling the road leading to the station. So applicants might choose to apply to a police service that offers them a higher salary than a police force in a city like Berlin that pays relatively little. Working conditions could be another factor. Police work is not a 9-to-5 job. Police officers work nights, weekends and public holidays. And with increasing crime levels in some parts of Germany and an increased terrorism threat, they often work much longer than they are supposed to. According to estimates compiled by the police union, all police officers in the whole of Germany worked 22 million hours more than they were legally supposed to last year. On top of that, there's an increased threat of violence. In the old days, police officers enjoyed great respect from the community. But that has changed, says Jörg Radek from the police union.
Das ist genau ein spannendes Feld. Auf der einen Seite eine sehr hohe Zuspruchsrate, die widerspiegelt die gesellschaftliche Anerkennung.
There are many citizens who greatly appreciate the work the police is doing. On the other hand, lack of respect for the police is growing. It starts with insults, but my colleagues also have to learn to deal with kicks, bites and physical injuries.
Despite the many negative headlines about the police in Germany, new recruits like Ugur are full of excitement. He says he can't wait to finish his training and join his colleagues on the streets of Berlin. He will be ready in about 18 months from now. He says he's not worried about the kind of situations that he could encounter.
Es ist klar, dass nicht jeder die Polizei liebt und schätzt und mag. Das wissen wir auch als Berliner Hauptstadtkind.
I know that not everybody loves and appreciates the police. After all, I grew up here in Berlin, and I know there are plenty of different cultures and people living here. But I feel up to the task, and I'm also able to learn more. Not every day is going to be the same once I've left the academy.
But in the meantime, Germany's police forces can only wait and hope that they will find many more young recruits who are as qualified and as excited about the job as Ugur is. Daniel Pelz, DW, Berlin.
Now, the tiny Baltic state of Estonia has only 1.3 million people, but it's built up a reputation as something of an IT superpower. It's the birthplace of Skype and claims to offer its entire population free Wi-Fi. It's one of the leaders in secure encrypted communication. Estonians can pay taxes and vote online using smart ID cards. And now the country offers a taste of that online future to everyone through its e-residency program. Rob Cameron has this report from Tallinn.
While some countries push people away,
Estonia pulls them in.
A promotional video for Estonia's e-residency program, now in its third year. The Estonian government says 25,000 people have already applied from 139 countries around the world.
To help scale internationally. What if you're a digital nomad or expat and want to run your company after you...
The application process is simple. Fill out a straightforward online form, pay a modest fee, wait for security checks by the Estonian authorities, and you'll receive what's called a transnational digital identity embedded in a credit-sized ID card. But the question is, why would you want to?
So this building used to be a paper mill. It's now been converted.
For an answer, I've come here to a converted factory in the suburbs of Tallinn, to the small office where the e-residency program is run. Adam Rang, a joint British-Estonian citizen with Baltic heritage, is the program's head of communication.
Estonia has a very advanced digital infrastructure and 1.3 million people living here in order to use it. But it was realized that Estonia's digital infrastructure can handle far more users, as it were, beyond the people living here. And that's how e-residency was created. Someone asked the question, what would happen if we handed out these digital identities to people around the world? It was launched just over 2 years ago. And to be honest, when e-residency was launched, no one knew precisely who was going to be most interested in signing up.
The authorities soon found it was entrepreneurs and small businesses who were most interested in e-residency. With the secure card, they can overcome a number of obstacles to doing business in a global market that's increasingly interconnected, but not always an even playing field, as Adam explains.
The main benefit of e-residency at present is the ability to start a company entirely online. That company is going to be an EU company. It's a location-independent company because you can run it very easily through our digital infrastructure. You know, more and more people are getting online and getting connected, but it doesn't mean that they've got the same opportunities. It really depends on where you live. There's a lot of restrictions in what services you can use. A lot of people are financially excluded. E-residency is a way that we're really tackling that in being able to democratize access to entrepreneurship and democratize access to services online that entrepreneurs need to grow their companies.
One example he gave me is PayPal. If you're an entrepreneur from Ukraine or Guinea-Bissau, for example, people won't be able to pay you using PayPal, the preferred option for so much online business these days. Obtain e-residency in Estonia, and that becomes possible. It's important to stress what e-residency is not. It does not give you citizenship or even the right of residence in Estonia or the EU. You must still pay your taxes in your home country, and you will probably need to open a bank account in Estonia to make it work, though that itself has become easier.
Big question is whether people will adopt this.
The very first person to receive e-residency was the British journalist Edward Lucas, senior editor of The Economist. He spent 4 years living in Estonia in the early 1990s and still has great affection for the country. He told me, if nothing else, the programme is brilliant PR for a small Baltic nation.
I can see why it's attractive, and I think it's a very good way for Estonia also to increase its sort of socio-cultural footprint all over the world. There are people maybe who've never been to Estonia, now many thousands of them, who've got a strong personal tie to Estonia and just see that, apart from all its other admirable qualities, Estonia's a country that actually works, that it's sort of fully fit for the digital economy of the 21st century in a way that very few other countries are.
You might be outside the EU, but want a trusted company registered inside the world's
largest... There's recently been a spike in applications from Britain as the deadline for Brexit looms. Remainers may be disappointed to learn that Estonian e-residency does not circumvent the reality of Britain leaving the EU, for all the reasons explained above. But for small businesses worried about the economic cost of crashing out of the single market, it may be an attractive prospect. Rob Cameron, DW, Tallinn.
El Rey Mago, appelle Wizkid. Chérie Mamaye, go.
Well, that's where we end today's show. Don't forget, if you missed any bit of the show or you want to listen again, you can visit our website, DW Africa, or our Facebook page. On behalf of the entire team here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Jane Nyinge. Thank you so, so much for your time. Regarde-moi et dis-moi, Faria, pour boire.